Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on data networking where real engineers get together to talk nerdy. Broadcasting today from our open source, free-to-air, GPL2 licensed virtual office, where you are responsible for participation, getting your own code, compiling it, making it go, and then contributing your changes back to the community. Because that's what the Packet Pushers does too. We put our show together to share with you details about the community from the community by the community. And I tell you what, if you're not excited, I am. Because when real engineers get together to talk nerdy, we don't have to apologize for talking technical, for waving our hands at the virtual whiteboard, and pretending that we know what all the discussion is about. Today, we are joined by two members of the Open Daylight Project to talk to us a little bit about what the changes are to do with controller codes and OpenFlow and software-defined networking. Now, I know many of you have probably heard enough about software-defined networking, but trust me, it's the future. As always, though, I'm joined by Mr. Ethan Banks this week. How are you, sir?
Good. A little just busy and so on. There's no lack of things to do in the networking world. Between the day job and the night job, I am fully occupied.
Outstanding. And also with us today is Mr. Brent Salisbury. Brent, how are you?
Doing well, Greg. Getting excited for this one. This is obviously something that I'm pretty excited about, and OpenFlow and SDN, and got the right people here to talk about it. Looking forward to it.
Definitely. And I'd like to welcome today Inder Gopal. Inder, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Inder Gopal. I guess I have two jobs. One, I work for IBM as responsibility for their networking products. And I'm also the chair of the newly formed Open Daylight Board of Directors.
Thanks very much for joining us today. And also with us is David Meyer. David.
Hi. My name is David Meyer. I'm currently the chair of the Open Daylight Technical Steering Committee. I'm the chief scientist and CTO over at Brocade, also a faculty computer scientist, a faculty over at the University of Oregon, among other things that I do in the industry.
Okay, so thanks very much for joining us today. What we wanted to do was recently the Open Daylight Project was started up. And it's a consortium of seven of the major networking vendors who've come together to agree on a coherent platform for an SDN controller. I guess, I don't know, David, do you want to try and summarize that a bit better, maybe go a little bit more detail about what the Open Daylight Project is?
Yeah, sure. The first thing I guess that's important about Open Daylight Project is that the scope is a little bit wider than just the controller. For those of you who know, controller is sort of a platform for building applications that are of interest to the networking community and beyond, actually, on top of. So while the controller is a primary component of the Open Daylight Project, it's the action in all of this is really going to be in the applications that run on top of it eventually. So, and it also, you know, I mean, if we think about it a little bit architecturally, it's sort of a middleware layer that sits between applications on the north side and switching gear via virtual or physical and, you know, various network kinds of appliances on the south side. So it's actually really more of Open Daylight is really more of an ecosystem.
So we have a hardware network with switches down the bottom. OpenFlow protocol talks to a controller. The controller then has applications which it talks to. And between the applications and the controller is a northbound API.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to point out is that the controller platform is designed to be very modular. And so from the southbound side of it, it can talk OpenFlow version 1 to, you know, 1, 1.3, 1.x or beyond. But it can also talk netconf, SNMP if people want it, I2RS, BGPLS, Alto, everything like that. So it's not really, it's got a wider vision than just what I've been calling OpenFlow SDN. I don't know if people have seen the taxonomy I built around this, but it's got a wider vision on the southbound side of that. And then on the northbound side of it, it also is very modular. It's using kind of a plug-in architecture, both directions actually, based on what's known as OSGI. So there's a modular architecture here that is intended to be able to support many southbound protocols and many northbound interfaces.
Just to add to what David said, right? It is it's certainly broader than the controller. it also does include, and many of the member companies have expressed interest in contributing components that are above the API layer, so really applications and services which will run on top of this infrastructure. And so really, I mean, the way David characterized it as an ecosystem, an assemblage of open source componentry, right, around this SDN space is probably, you know, a more accurate way of characterizing it. It is much more than a controller, though the controller is obviously a core piece of this. The other thing I would just add to perhaps just clarify what you said in the introduction is it is more than seven companies. It's about, I don't even remember the exact number now because it's growing day by day, but it's about 22 companies, I believe, at this point in time. And it's more than networking companies. I mean, if you look at the people, the companies that are at the table, it includes, obviously a lot of the networking companies, also includes a lot of software companies like Microsoft and VMware, includes systems companies like IBM, HP, Dell. So there's a really wide assemblage of players that have come around here to create this. It's much broader than the core networking players, primarily because SDN is something that's going to affect not just the network, but the applications, services, I mean, a whole lot of other things in the data center, which go beyond.
Yeah, the way it's been presented to me is that Open Daylight was originally set up by the seven big players to form a consortium, and then other people have joined in once it was clear that it had sufficient momentum to move.
No. Even at the start, when we launched Open Daylight, it had about 19 players. Right. So I don't know where the number seven came from, but that's not.
Well, that's probably platinum members, right?
No, it's 10 platinum members.
One thing that, you know, I think that maybe we can clarify here up front that might be helpful is it's an open source project. And so that really means that while there's a consortium and there's memberships, and you said platinum, and, you know, there's a membership tiered membership structure. Anybody can write code, commit code, or at least provide patches that they would like to have as part of it. Anybody can use it. It's open source in that way. So while there's membership and there's consortiums and governance structure, because every open source project has to have that, it also has, you know, the open source component that, you know, what's going to make it successful is a wide and diverse group of developers that are using this platform, just like any other open source project.
So you bring up I think the only reason this is going to be successful is the fact that it's open source. You know, it's not the loudest in the room. It's not who pays the most money. It's here's the best of the best of each of the vendor, and the code they contribute is their worth to the project.
Agreed with that. But, you know, like every other open source project, once we get going, you know, we're hoping that we'll have a diverse set of committer developer communities and committers. And, you know, the trajectory that all of this takes will be community driven over time.
What happens where software meets hardware? I mean, I still think that's a fundamental crux that's missing. And that's, you know, what's coming out of the ONF? Is that getting adopted in the Southbound API from Daylight?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's pretty easy, though, to be honest with you. The ONF currently, I mean, you know, the ONF is, as you know, is, you know, evolving its kind of thinking. But currently, the concrete thing that the ONF is doing is OpenFlow, the protocol, and OFConfig, right? And now there's this optical transport stuff going on, too. But basically, let's just stay with the OpenFlow and perhaps OS Config. By the way, I didn't mention that there can be an OFConfig Southbound plugin. Of course there can be, right? The plugin architecture, I mean, this interacts with the SAL. That was one of your questions about the SAL. But basically, the idea behind the plugin architecture there is that any Southbound interface that anybody wants to do, they're completely welcome to do so. So in particular, there's great synergy between the ONF and the Open Daylight in the sense that Open Daylight isn't in the business of building standards. Open Daylight uses standardized technology, implementations of standardized technology, for example, OpenFlow, as Southbound APIs in this case. And so it's a perfect synergy, actually.
It makes sense. I don't see the ONF as being obsolete per se, or, you know, I see the Open Daylight project sitting above. OpenFlow is one Southbound API that enabled this whole evolutionary process in the networking industry by saying we can change the way packets are forwarded through our networks. Instead of handling each one as a packet, let's treat them as a flow. Okay, now if you've got a flow, you can actually think of the entire end-to-end connection instead of just thinking as everything is hop, 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 hop. And that changes the way you look at your network, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, one way you can think about it is that, I mean, the Daylight project, Open Daylight, doesn't obsolete the ONF, to use your term, any more than it would say obsolete the IETF, right? I mean, those are places where the northbound and southbound standards are made, right? Now, on the other hand, an open source, part of the nice thing about open source is that you can on occasion come up with de facto standards, and the examples of these would be sort of like HTTP or SIP or any of those kind of things, which were never really actually standardized until later. So that's a great opportunity to have a community-driven standardized proto-standard environment, and then, you know, you can always go back and standardize something when you find the need. And I think a really good example of that would be something like POSIX, right?
I mean, SIP as an example, but so Cisco bastardized SIP for years. Everybody agreed on one way, and then Cisco did it another way, and then there was this huge interoperability gap for 2 or 3 years. So,
yeah, and that's where you kind of need standards, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, my point was, like HTTP, SIP really didn't come from the IETF.
Right.
It was retroactively standardized.
I mean, an example here would be perhaps some of the northbound APIs, right? I mean, you know, it's hard to standardize these things with a specification, you know, or paper specification. Whereas if you actually have running code, it becomes a lot easier to create, as Dave says, potentially either a de facto standard or eventually something that actually becomes a formal standard. So, I think, particularly in some of the northbound APIs, I think that's perhaps where, you know, Daylight, you know, can help drive some of the convergence around standards. But I think for the most part, our job is really going to be implementing, you know, what's already been standardized and delivering, you know, components and systems that people can use either, you know, as open source directly or as part of vendor products, you know, indirectly.
You know, the one thing, guys, you know, that I kind of try to stay away from, and I probably used these terms here already, and so, you know, my bad, but basically northbound and southbound are really confusing terms because they're really relative to what you're looking at, and it's not one thing. So, for example, in Daylight, in the Open Daylight, in the south, in what we're calling southbound, underneath the controller, there's not one API there. There's not like a southbound API. Actually, what there is a framework for modularizing southbound APIs, so sets of these things. On the north side, I guess on the other side of the controller, we really want to have sort of a model-driven approach so that you can get this API, the interface set, whatever that happens to be, that's consistent with what application you're trying to write, and have it be model driven. So an example of this would be, I'm not saying this is the way this is going to get done, but I'm just giving you an example is, you know, where you have a model driven architecture, something like what you'd get from TLF, right? You give it a Yang model and it generates whatever language bindings you want. You don't codify that into the, and you don't hard code that basically.
Yeah. You don't want to just do a table lookup like we do with SNMP because the tables don't, that what seems like a good idea today loses its logic tomorrow. You need something that can be self-encapsulating and self-generating and self-changes over time to adapt.
Extensible, evolvable, and scalable.
That. So all those good words. So
that's all you need.
I think the I think summarizing there, the ONF is still fairly important. I think one of the most important parts of the ONF is actually the division called the FOR, which is talking about the silicon architectures that can support OpenFlow. I know you're talking about lots of southbound protocols so that the environment can evolve, you know, and different vendors, you know, Juniper's Contrail division is off using XMPP in the southbound direction. Other ones are using MPLS as a southbound protocol. I think the fork is still really important over at the ONF for the ability to use OpenFlow into hardware abstraction too.
Yeah, I mean, if that kind of abstraction becomes something that silicon, you know, merchant silicon vendors or other silicon vendors can build efficiently and it finds application, it'll fit perfectly into the framework that's being built in the Open Daylight project.
Yeah. I guess it's important to separate the applications versus OpenFlow. So OpenFlow is the way we configure the switches effectively, or configure.
It's one way. It's one way. I want to make sure. I want to make sure that that we understand that OpenFlow is one way, but there will be others. There are others.
Yeah, that'll be right. So, in my opinion.
But it's hard to say that this is, let me say, OpenSDN. If there is closed control mechanisms on that kit, that is the only way I can instantiate policy to it. I mean, I think that's
well, you know, it's really interesting that you say that, because I've struggled with this quite a bit. As you know, you've seen my talks probably, and I kind of, it's one of those more questions than answers kind of situation. But think about it this way: if you had something like I2RS, which is being standardized in the IETF right now. It's basically a way of inserting routes and other things, but let's stay with this one. It's basically a way of putting routes into a RIB, right? And it uses a RIB as an arbitration mechanism between other processes that are generating routes, right? Now, if you had a mechanism by which you could ensure that the route you put into the RIB via I2RS was made it its way into the FIB and then was downloaded into the hardware, then in a way, it wouldn't be exactly the same as configuring flows, because you're still in the hop-by-hop paradigm in most cases. But you would be able to build a control plane that way. In the Cisco parlance,
really...
if you inserted routes with administrative distance zero, say, for example.
But you're really not changing anything. You're still only destination routing.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, that's sort of a different. That's a little bit of a different question, right?
Yeah, I2RS doesn't change the world. It just puts a little bit of cream on top of the cake, or maybe a cherry. But that's it. It doesn't fix the underlying problem of we need a smarter forwarding plane that's far more flexible and far more creative than what we've got today. Your ability to add routes to a router without using BGP or LDP is hardly, there's much more at stake here. That whole I2RS thing looks like a dead loser to me, unless you're a carrier who doesn't want to change anything but thinks he can go half, you know, like get half pregnant.
Yeah, I'm just suggesting that, you know, there are other models out there, that's all. And we want to encompass all of them.
Yeah, and I think that's... Sorry. Yeah. I think it'd be interesting maybe for core stitching. I mean, obviously... a 12-tuple match and at your 100-gig core may not make a whole lot of sense under current hardware. So, I mean, I think there is that's that hybrid approach. You've got OpenFlow on the edge and then something in the middle to bring it together, whether it's LSPs, whether it's I2RS, and just dumping it to an IGP, EGP. I think that's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about the ODP governance structure and maybe direct this question towards Inder. So, Inder, what's the difference between the members of the ODP and their platinum, gold, silver status? Does it really affect much, or is it just some sort of a badge of honor?
Well, there are some tangible differences, right? Though, as David said, I mean, everyone, you know, has the ability to contribute and, contribute both project ideas as well as code. But there are, as you said, three levels of membership. There's platinum, gold, and silver. Platinum comes with some, each of these things come with commitments of money. So there's sort of fees associated, membership fees associated with each level, commitments of developers, and commitments of intellectual property contributions. So if you take Platinum as an example, Platinum is a two-year commitment, $500,000 a year, and 10 full-time developers on the project, and a significant amount of intellectual property committed. Well, significant is kind of a subjective definition, but a significant amount of intellectual property committed as part of the entry into the Platinum status. So that's a pretty hefty level of commitment. Gold is a little bit less, and silver is less. Platinum brings with you a guaranteed board seat. So you have the ability to influence the direction, to help make decisions, investment decisions, and so forth, and you know, and on the project. And it also comes with a TSC seat. So you will be sitting on the TSC board and help provide technical direction to the overall project. So and you know, gold comes with somewhat less, and silver comes with less. So there is that they are, you know, privileges associated with each level. There are also expectations from each of these levels that are commensurate with the privileges.
Yeah.
I just want to kind of point out that this is a real live open source project, so anybody can contribute from the community. So you don't have to be a great programmer either. I've made a commit, you know, just to kind of test it out and see if I commit, and I got pushed. And
yep.
So.
Yep, anyone can. And it's a meritocracy. I mean, you know, what you know, the board governs business decisions, you know, makes, you know, controls budgets and things like that. The technical steering committee, which David is a chair, really, you know, makes technical decisions. So it makes decisions on what projects to initiate, you know, how to advance projects, you know, in terms of their life cycle. So those are two different bodies. The board doesn't have any overseeing ability over the technical steering committee. It operates as an independent entity. So it really is a technical meritocracy. We try very much to make decisions. And, you know, the technical steering committee is completely open. You know, anyone can dial in and listen in to the meetings that happen every week. You know, there's the dialogue there is really based upon the technical merits of a particular decision. There have been some, you know, interesting and important decisions that we've had to make so far. And if you guys have listened in on some of that, you'll observe that we try very hard to decide what is in the best interest of the community. We try to put our parochial interests aside and put on our open daylight community hats and try to make our decisions based upon that to the best of our ability.
So you'll probably notice that the first decision I made as chair was to open up all of the steering committee, technical steering committee dialogue. So as Inder pointed out, the phone calls are open to whoever wants to join, and the list is open to whoever wants to join to see. Because I think one of the very important things about open source projects is transparency, and we're trying to build the best transparency we can into the process and into everything we do.
It's pretty, I mean, so you can literally listen to a WebEx of a TSC. I mean, it's probably transparency the point of borderline destruction, but it's pretty awesome. I think that's actually gonna change. I think that should change some other open source projects and kind of going into this hype.
Yeah, you know, Brent, it was clear to me that that had to be done, you know, and I think it's worked really well to date. And in fact, it's so open that actually anybody can talk during the TSC meetings. I don't know if you listened to the last couple of them, but that actually even works pretty well. Non-TSC members included.
Yeah, I think we really did that, right? I mean, you know, Ted took that decision really because there was a lot of concern going into the formation of Open Daylight that it was, you know, a bunch of large players, you know, getting together and somehow creating something that was freezing out, you know, smaller players or trying to, you know, effectively, you know, slow down the advance of SDN. And so we felt, firstly, that it very much is not the case, and we also felt it was really important for us to demonstrate that to the community. And I think, you know, Dave's decision to open things up and allow participation, I think, has been a key in getting people to understand that, you know, we have large players and small players at the table. They all have one vote, effectively.
Yeah.
Decisions get made. Well,
that, I mean, that was part of the criticisms that we've been leveling at the ONF is that everything's done in secret. I can't join in until I pay $30,000 to get to the table. Mm-hmm. I can't join I can't afford to fly from here to San Francisco to join in the conversation every 3 weeks because I do real jobs, right? I have a real job. I want to track what's happening with OpenFlow and Open Daylight and all those sorts of things, but I actually have to go to work 50 hours a week and can't. I'm not like a vendor who's quite happy to pay $1 million to put 10 resources on the ground and then fly them off to wherever it is to get together. The only way I can participate is if these things are open.
Well, first off, if you want to join any of the lists, go to lists.opendaylight.org. All of the lists that are there, and you can join any of the ones that you want. Secondly, there's a site called wiki.opendaylight.org, and that's where all of the information about when the TSC calls are posted, the minutes of the TSC calls, all the details, and all the technical material. So lists.opendaylight.org and wiki.opendaylight.org. You know, please come along.
Well, that leads into a good...
Please participate.
Okay, so that leads us to how does someone from the community, so we know that the vendors have got a seat at the table, and rightly so, because they often have the right people and the right skills and the access to information, right? So how does someone from the community go about contributing, David? Do they just start joining in the calls and start giving code in, and that's how, like any open source project?
Exactly. This is just a classic open source project. And, you know, in any open source project, code is the coin of the realm, right? It's a meritocracy. So if you start committing code and you start being a participant, you're going to start being a decision maker, and you're going to start being part of how the whole trajectory of Open Daylight. But let me say something about the structure of the TSC for the folks out there who may or may not know this. So basically right now, the Platinum members, the TSC consists of representatives of the Platinum members because we needed to boot up the TSC and the entire project. So in the fullness of time, the way the TSC will work and should work is that the members of the TSC will be the technical leads of the core projects of the Open Daylight projects. So that means that anybody from the community can wind up on the TSC if they become the lead of a core project, which they can by committing code in the normal way that you do, or design in the normal way that you do in a open source project. So while I'm the chair of the TSC and on the TSC right now, a measure of success for me will be when I'm not it anymore, because that will mean that a developer who's very active in one or more of the core projects has taken over. So I'm looking forward to that. Not because I don't like it. I mean, I like doing it. Don't get me wrong on that. But I mean, I think that this is a structural imperative for the project, and it'll happen.
Dave, that definitely sounds like you guys took a play out of the OpenStack playbook, which I think is perfect. What's the timeline on getting there? And then what are some of the projects you would see as being... Do you all have those identified yet as what those core projects are?
We don't. We have a life cycle, and there are proposals for core projects, but projects move through this life cycle. And the life cycle, you can find the life cycle on the wiki page I pointed you at. And right now, the projects are in what are called either proposed, or we had a special category called bootstrap just to try to get things going. So... But in the fullness of time, people will come with, and this is already starting, by the way, and I'll give an example. But the idea here is people will come with projects, and those projects will be proposed to the TSC, and the TSC will advance them according to the life cycle in our governance structure. Now, let me give an example of one that just was proposed. It's the virtual tenant network proposal from the NEC people. So they put together a proposal consistent with all of the kind of structural components that they need to do to build a project proposal under Open Daylight, and that's just going to move ahead according to what the TSC decides through the life cycle. And anybody could do that. These guys happen to be from NSC, but anybody in the world can do this. Yeah. So I want to make the point again is that while NEC happens to be part of the a member of Open Daylight, that is really not operative with respect to whether or not they could make this proposal or not. Anybody can make a proposal. And in time, there will be people making proposals who aren't from any of the members. That will be a measure of success.
Hey, David, would you maybe go through the Dixon Erickson? So IBM, and so I think before you even get into it, I think pointing out that David Erickson is the, in my opinion, he is the community representative. I mean, there's some fantastic people on the TSC. Ed Warnick is great. Rob Sherwood's great. Benson, Colin, all those guys. But IBM and David Erickson from Stanford put together a proposal that took these BSN, Big Switch Networks proposed controller, and then the Cisco proposed controller, and did a pretty monumental job of pulling out the best of both things and trying to show something consolidated.
Yeah, so let me say a few things about that. First off, for those of you who don't know, David Erickson, he was the original author of Beacon, so he's incredibly knowledgeable. I mean, he and a really good guy. So he came together with Colin Dixon as two representatives of the community. In particular, they were not associated with either of the existing controller projects, what we were calling controller, which was the Cisco contributed code base, and the network platform, which was the BSN contributed code base. You'll see this in the documentation on the wiki. Let me just say that again. The project called Controller, or Open Daylight Controller, is the Cisco contributed code, and the code called Network Platform is the BSN contributed code. So don't get confused about that. And by the way, if you have any questions about any of this, just send mail to the TSC. The list is, you can send mail to the list if you like, and we'll answer whatever questions you have. So Colin Dixon at IBM and David Erickson came together to put together a framework. So the Dixon-Erickson proposal, as it's been called, was really a framework for how to do integration of these two code bases. And it was fairly high level, but it was by design fairly high level because it was supposed to be a framework. And now what has happened is the next step, we've drilled down one more layer on that, and we have a proposal for basically how to take the host tracker from the network platform code and integrate it with and replace the basically what's basically the host tracker and the ARP handler in the controller code or in the Cisco code. And this is an excellent exercise in how to do this. And so Colin Dixon wrote this up, and it's a really nice framework for how to do these, moving these pieces of code back and forth. And in fact, he invented a component called an adapter bundle, which is a bundle is a OSGI concept. So an adapter bundle that adapts one to the other. And then Ed Warnicki from Cisco, having seen that, built such an adapter bundle. So things are really moving rapidly on the Dixon-Erickson framework right now. We've made, in the last week, I would say we made a month's worth of progress. So it's really happening rapidly right now. So anybody who wants to get in on that, please come along and get in on it.
You're building interfaces for these modules to plug into.
Yeah, I mean, actually, one of the core architectural tenets of all of this is modularity, and that was carried through to the Dixon-Erickson proposal. That there are modularity frameworks inside the core controller platform, like I mentioned, OSGI and others.
OpenStack integrations, I think I've already seen some of that. Is that already in the world? I know a lot of people out there are interested in OpenStack.
I mean, so there's a lot of OpenStack. What does OpenStack integration mean? Does it mean you have a quantum plugin? And if you have a quantum plugin, where does it fit? North, south, where? There's other kinds of, maybe we want to do storage and other kinds of things like that. So all of that stuff, OpenStack gives us a lot of ways to interface. And I think, almost every one of those is being exercised right now. So like I said, quantum and others.
Where are you guys at on, so this East-West Controller Federation, how are you going to exchange state between multiple controllers? And is that something that would be in scope of the project?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I've always claimed that controller to controller, or let's just call it East-West like you did for now, that interface needs to be standardized because that would allow, I've claimed that, that's my opinion. And others agree, but I kind of look like a controller is really among other things, but its main job is, or one of its main jobs is state management. And you might want to, as a consumer of this technology, drop in either your own open source piece of control infrastructure or somebody else's, and you would expect that they would interoperate. It'd be like saying, oh, I have my ISIS implementation and you have your ISIS implementation, but they don't interoperate. That would be strange, I would guess. So I've always been strongly in favor of a standardized East-West protocol, so you can have basically a distributed controller infrastructure with different controller platforms. That's kind of my view of it.
Google recently talked about what they've started doing, and it's almost they're starting to create this hierarchy. So just like we do modularity and hierarchy to achieve scale today, they're doing that same kind of thing with their controllers and NIBs.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's really interesting. I've talked about this quite a bit recently, and there's quite a few nice SIGCOM papers on this topic. But, you know, the early days of OpenFlow SDN, it was a centralized controller, right? And then we all know that in order to get scale and resilience, we need distributed systems, right? So now you have a distributed system, controller system, which really is just a distributed system, and it has all of the state management and consistency requirements and variables that any distributed system has. And those, actually, the kind of consistency model that you put into the controller really is fairly important, because it is a primary determinant about how fast the control plane can converge. So, among other things. But, you know, that's one of the issues that we've been talking about quite a bit in Open Daylight. What is the state consistency model that we want to adopt, or how can we make that flexible? Right now in networking, in the network world, we use something called eventual consistency, which if you talk to somebody in distributed systems, they'll say, well, you know, what's that? Because it's not very precise. But that's one of the ways we've been able to get the network to be as resilient and convergent as it is.
All right. So, I mean, when you start getting to consider, you've got eventual and then you've got full. Right, so full,
yeah, and everything.
Full is reactive, so a switch boots up and attaches to a controller, and now you have, you know, this immediate consistency.
Yeah, so, and everything in between.
So proactive OpenFlow is really no different from BGP, because it's this eventual consistency, right? Switch boots up, starts loading in flows, and then consistent at some point. It's something I think that everybody struggled with, including vendors, including the ONF. Nobody can, I mean, the ONF just put together this migration working group. But it's made up of researchers. So I really think what would be great to come out of this project is, here's how you take a chunk, an island. So BSN talks about islands of SDN. I think it's really important. It can't be glossed over. It's how do I take this island and integrate it into the network, and then maybe even have an island on the other end that I get stitched together through. I would hope that's not out of the scope of this project, because it really does need IGPs, you know, some kind of integration between the two to redistribute.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because we have this other call for everyone out there. There's yet another call called the technical workstream call on Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock Pacific time, where we try to spend as much time on technical issues as we can. And this issue was occupied probably half an hour or more yesterday, because it's an obvious problem that we need to solve.
Cool. So it's on the radar.
Definitely. Oh. Islands, open flow islands, or legacy islands, or either way, however you put it.
That's right. However we do it doesn't really matter. It's going to be difficult to find ways to match. You know, you can't always bet on the customer being able to rip out and replace everything to put in new something. You have to find a way to transition in most cases. Although some people are trying to make the argument that people don't build data centers gradually. They don't change them over the life cycle. They only build them once. They only ever change the network once, and that's when the data center is built.
Well, and that's so much, I mean, it totally reflects.
There's a certain amount of truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, the enterprise, that's how, I mean, Greg, you and I, our two shops life cycle completely different. You life cycle probably with x86. Yeah. We life cycle when it's fried or we happen to get some kind of money. You know, the rare every 7-10 years. That
anytime your network upgrades is when it's medically unfit for duty and it gets carried out in an ambulance.
Yeah, it's horrible, but it's true, and it's so expensive to do it.
Well, we only do that because the networking equipment is so expensive, because we pay so much for hardware and we pay so much for software and we pay so much for licensing. I would make the point that networking is overpriced in terms of the value that you get. I would rotate my networking equipment faster if I wasn't spending as much money on it. So if I could get the same features and values out of a switch but throw it away every 2 years like my server guys do, then I'd deploy new stuff every 2 or 3 years because it would be worthwhile doing it. So I guess one of the things that we should point out with is that today's podcast was actually put together with help from the Linux Foundation. The Open Dial-Up Daylight Project is actually part of the – is managed or run by the Linux Foundation or runs under the auspices of. And I'd like to thank the Linux Foundation for joining us and helping us to set up the show today.
You know, I've never worked with the Linux Foundation before this, but I have to say they're great. And their people are really good. They're very diligent and they're highly professional. They're great.
There is no special connection to Linux in the Open Daylight project, right? I mean, it is under the Linux Foundation, but the artifacts produced in Open Daylight really will work across a whole bunch of different operating system platforms. The value the Linux Foundation brings to Open Daylight, which is considerable, as Dave said, is really the expertise that they have on running and best practices associated with open source. And having their experience and how to run open source projects has been really a real boon for us. But it isn't part of Linux in any way.
No, it's just part of the Linux Foundation under the auspices of their organization and rules, which helps you get going that much faster because there's a pre-packed methodology, process, resources, things like that.
Precisely.
I just want to mention that.
Yeah.
And there's value in that because that's a recognized name. In the same way as when we see a standard come from the IETF, we automatically know things about the standard. There's been some quality control about the processes and the people, and we know where they are. Organizations like ANSI, not so much. You know, all the ITU.
Yeah, we'll leave that for another day.
Yeah, we can argue that out another day. All right, I think we've taken this about as far as we can go. We've talked a little bit through what the Open Daylight Project is, how you can be involved in the community, and there's a bunch of links in the show notes where you can come along and find out how you can participate. Open Daylight looks to be a very exciting initiative, and Brent is all excited. Like, you can literally see him bouncing up and down on his chair. You can hear but that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Inder for coming on the show this week. What are you going to be doing in the week ahead, Inder? Anything exciting?
Actually, I'm going to be traveling out to the West Coast and experiencing some of the beautiful weather that you have out there, hopefully. But it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this, and please go explore the links that David provided earlier in the show. And looking forward to have you all be active participants in Open Daylight.
Thanks very much. And David, I look forward to catching up with you perhaps later in the year when we visit as part of Tech Field Day. But why don't you tell people where they can find you in the meantime?
Yeah, so people can always find me at DMM, David Mary, three letters, DMM at Brocade or DMM at eOregon or DMM at almost anywhere works. And so I'm around. So, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing any thoughts that anybody out there has on Open Daylight. And if you're still not sure how to participate, what you can do, just drop me an email.
Thanks very much for coming on the show this week. Mr. Brent Salisbury, where can people find you, mate?
On Twitter at NetworkStatic, and I'll be blogging as usual at networkstatic.net.
Okay, and just for those of you who don't know, Brent and I are in the final phases of collaborating on writing a book about OpenFlow, which is why I'm a bit one-eyed about it, but that's okay. I still think it's the future, and so keep an eye on our blogs to find out more about that. And finally, Mr. Ethan Banks, anything exciting in your week ahead?
I'm continuing the process of a voice over IP network hardware swap out to support power and phones and quality of service and all that good stuff. That is finally coming to a close, and I've got a number of writing projects underway for several publications online. And you can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks, and of course, Network Computing and PacketPushers.net.
And I should also mention, and should have mentioned it a while ago, is that Packet Pushers will be taking its wheelbarrow, which is full of recording equipment, over to Cisco Live. Cisco has engaged us to go and cover the event and to record a bunch of content there. So we are looking forward to meeting those of you who are lucky enough to get a ticket. And keep an eye out for us. We'll be wandering around there doing some social media events while I'm there, I'm sure. And we'd love to talk to you in person instead of you just listening to people like me say. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show. And so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you are thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on today's show, or follow us on the Twitter as @packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.